Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about science. We're going to be talking about chemistry, but we're looking at a bigger picture, not a particular little topic, not a dusty corner of the periodic table like germanium, tin, and lead, my favorites. But we're going to be talking to the next president of the American Chemical Society. And let me put that into perspective. The American Chemical Society has got about 200,000, I'll say, members, and that'll be corrected later on, I'm sure, and therefore is the biggest scientific organization or academy, if you like, in the world. And a large number of those, of course, are in America, and a large number are abroad, all over the world. So it's got a reach. And so the president of this society has the potential to have a lot of influence on various social topics associated with science. So who's going to talk about this? Well, we've had him on the program once before when he ran as a candidate. It was about 3 or 4 years ago. His name is Dr. Luis Echegoyen. He's actually on the faculty at the University of Texas here in El Paso. And Luis, welcome back to Science Studio, now as the president, not the candidate.
Thank you very much for having me back, Keith. I guess my official title is president-elect.
Okay.
I have been president-elect since the beginning of this year, since January 1.
So you're used to it now. You've had 8 months almost of being president-elect.
As used as you will get. Let me put it that way. It's a lot of work.
I can believe it. I've known several other presidents. And in my humble way, I was president of the Texas Academy of Science, and that had enough work just for a tiny little organization. Okay, so before we get into, you know, what you're going to do as the president, why you ran, what are the big issues that I think the general public should be sort of apprised about, let's go back to Luis as a little boy. Where did you grow up, and did you ever think when you were a little kid that you were going to be a chemist?
I'm one of those who, from early age, I knew that science was one of the main things that I was interested in. I wasn't obviously completely married to the idea that I was going to be a chemist or a physicist or this. But
you probably didn't know the distinction very early on.
Right. But since, I would say, since, and since you asked where did I grow up, I was born in Cuba, and I grew up until I was 10 years old. That's when, 1960, you may remember the date, January 1, 1959, that's when Castro took over. It took my father a year and a half to get out of there. But we were some of the first people to leave because things were not very defined as communistic.
So you would have been classified as upper middle class because it tended to be people that had resources that saw them threatened that would be leaving.
Yes. Yeah, my father was a TV comedian. He was the most famous comedian on both radio initially and then in TV. I have pictures of him with Bob Hope and with people like that who used to go and visit Havana. He was a very, very handsomely rewarded for his work. So I was very high middle class, if not even higher than that, when I
just
was
out of jokes. That's lovely.
Just out of,
yes. I mean, and he didn't have a reputation that was solid enough to be able to poke holes in a new political regime that he really didn't agree to.
No,
that wasn't on.
In those days, actually, there was a very interesting transformation. My father was the biggest fanatic of Castro because Castro was going to get Cuba rid of Batista and so on, right? Yes. Which was a very, very worthy cause, no question about it. And he came in like the big savior, right? So he was going to be the guy who was going to change Cuba in the right way and so on. So my father used to sit at the TV station. I don't know if you're familiar with the fact that Castro used to give speeches that lasted 4 and 5 hours and so on.
Right.
My father would be sitting on the floor, sitting throughout his 4 hours of speeches just because he was mesmerized with Castro, who was a fantastic speaker, fantastic. It was not until the agrarian reform came into place that my father started saying, this sounds a little bit too socialized and too socialist. Not necessarily communism, but I think he was, even at that time, thinking about this may just degenerate into something that is not going to be good. Funny, when we left, my father bought round-trip tickets. He was convinced that the U.S. would intervene and that we would be back. he never did. So we still have the return tickets.
I'd like to see those. Sure. I mean, that's worth putting them on the internet somewhere, just to, the optimism of a comedian, of course.
Yes, he was convinced. So he left our house and so on. He left some relatives in charge of. He was absolutely convinced that this is just a matter of a year or so. But anyway, that's history. So yeah. I left.
Wait a minute. Yeah, what happened to that house? I mean, it was a succession of relatives, or they all left?
Yeah, they left. Everyone left except for one aunt, and she had another house, so she never took over this house. Okay. So it now belongs. It's in private hands now. It went to the government for a while. Now it's in private hands. I have actually visited them.
And indeed, what one sees from a distance is that Cuba is sort of moving much more back into private enterprise of a small, but it's a step, and it's an irrevocable step.
Yes. And the people who I have actually visited the house twice. The first time was actually very interesting because when the house was built in 1955, I guess, or 56, when they poured the concrete for the garage. My father, he was one of these kind of nutcases, very sublime artist, really. But he had a vision, a very, very visionary. And so he requested one corner to be left fresh for his handprint, my brother's and mine. So I went there looking for the handprints. And they were still there, by the way.
Lovely.
But I was looking at the people who live in the house. They looked out and said, what the heck is this guy doing? Right. So I said, sorry, I don't mean to. And said, come right in. And they invited me to visit the house. And they gave me coffee and so on.
Wonderful.
So it was very pleasant.
So an interesting background. And you obviously got reasonably good grounding in early science and math, mm-hmm. even up to the age of 10.
Yes.
And then you went to Puerto Rico, as I understand
That's
it,
correct.
Right?
Yeah, we moved directly. We never stayed in the U.S. because my father's English was very poor. So he was supposed to have a job in Puerto Rico lined up.
All right,
he did. He became, interestingly, which shows what happened to many Cubans and I guess happens to many people. When you're good at something, it doesn't matter where you are. You become equally famous or wherever you go. People who were millionaires in Cuba left with nothing, and a year later they were millionaires in Miami. Right?
I mean, you see it in our own game of chemical research. You know, in a sense, you know, once you apprise what the facilities are, now I'm going straight into this sort of science. When you see what the facilities are in a laboratory or an environment, a department, you know. The clever ones, the bright ones, the imaginative ones can do anything there.
Yes.
You just begin to say, well, this is what I'd like to do. But by God, we don't have this, this, and this, but we do have something like this. And the game begins.
Yes.
You know, it's just the inquisitiveness.
The creativity has no parallel and no substitute. In Puerto Rico, since you mentioned Puerto Rico, I went there when I was 10, and I went through all my formative years, schooling, as well as a BS degree in chemistry, which I finished in 3 years, and then my PhD I did there as well in another 3 years. Did we have all the instrumentation in the world? Not even close, right? But
I remember visiting in the mid-70s. I mean, you may not have even... You may have been a student, in fact, when I first
I graduated PhD 74.
Okay, so I mean, probably I came after that. But you're right. I mean, first of all, there was no air conditioning, right? I mean, certain rooms maybe had it, you know. Which reminded me very much of Hawaii, because I went to Hawaii about 10 years later for a sabbatical. And the same thing there.
Yep.
And yet people can do creative things.
Yes.
Okay.
I will say this in really not to sound... I don't want to boast or be arrogant, but my advisor was a very creative individual. So he had the right ideas. He had one old EPR spectrometer, and he figured what he was going to do. And by the time I finished my PhD in 3 years, I had published 9 articles, 3 in the Journal of the American Chemical Society and 6 in the Journal of Physical Chemistry. So that gives you an idea.
All on EPR.
All on EPR. Yeah, that's
right. I mean, that story is reminiscent of one of our colleagues, Michael Eastman. He came here in 70, just before I did, and he had an old EPR with a wonderful magnet, though. The console was terrible, but the magnet was wonderful. And he had this little rubber hammer that he'd have to be delicately tapping in different parts of the console for it to sort of catch on fire and get good data. And it was wonderful to watch him. Okay, so you're creative, you've been successful, and now towards the middle of the end of a career, you're going to be the president of this ACS, the American Chemical Society. And I admired you because you ran three times. You were beaten by interesting people. Well, beaten. You were outvoted by other interesting people twice. And yet you persisted. And this is a story I like to tell people. You know, just because you lose something once, you know, come back. Hit at it again. Because if you've got the right ideas, people will sort of come around and say, well, this actually is what we need. So what was it that you told us this time that we need from you in the ACS?
Yeah, well, I think creativity is important, but I think tenacity is equally important. Right? You have to hang on to whatever it is that you want to do. The truth is the ACS comes to you. There is a committee called Nominations and Elections, and they are the ones who decide who are the people that they would like to see run.
Sounds like Stalin and sounds like Putin. I mean, it's
But I'll be honest with you. When they came the third time around, this committee, and said, would you run again? The initial response was, no, I've been there, and I don't really want to go through the process. They insisted, and I talked to some people, and they said, especially Fraser Stoddart, who you know, Nobel laureate from 2016, who is a very, very good friend. I said, what do you think about this? You have to do it because of chemistry and so on and so forth. So he persuaded me to run again.
Right. And let me just interject here, because you didn't come to this as a neophyte. I mean, apart from being an academic, publishing papers and the like, you had spent 3 or 4 years, I don't exactly remember how many, at the National Science Foundation in D.C. as a senior member of the staff, specializing in chemistry, but allocating all the wonderful funds that the federal government gives you. And so you have that much clearer administrative and big picture idea than some.
And it's funny and interesting because as an assistant professor, and even when I became an associate professor in Miami, I was a typical assistant professor dedicated to science and nothing else. And I would even get upset when people suggested that I should become chair of a department or run any administrative position. I think you're one of those who has stuck to your guns from the beginning. I didn't. At one point in my career, they came from Clemson and they said, well, do you want to be chair? And I said, why not? And it's a way for you to do things that transcend just your own science in the laboratory.
That's right. And gets you out of that dusty corner of the periodic table.
And the impact is fantastic. I feel very proud of the 4 years that I was division director for chemistry. I got extra money for chemistry. I did all kinds of things for the chemistry community. I feel extremely, extremely happy that I did it and very proud of the things that
That's
we accomplished.
Good. We'll take a break here. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Luis Echegoyen, President-elect of the American Chemical Society. And when we come back, we'll talk about what Luis Echegoyen is going to do or attempt to do in his presidency. Welcome back
we'll
to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Luis Echegoyen as President-elect of the ACS, American Chemical Society. So, what are you going to do? What you set yourself goals because you're goal-oriented. I know that. And so, you know, we do this program again in a year and a half. You can sit back as you did just now with what you did at the National Science Foundation. What do you think you'll have what do you want to have accomplished?
Well, I have many things. I ran on the basis of four ideas or things that I would like to do. Right now, I'm concentrating on what can I really effectively institute or put in place during my presidential year, which will be 2020. By the way, I call myself the president with the perfect vision because it's 2020. anyway, sorry for the bad joke.
The father raises his head.
anyway, so first thing I want to really implement is that next year I want to have it's really something copied to some degree from the German system. They have had this conference called the Lindau Conference, where Nobel laureates get together for about 5 days, many of them, like 30 or 40 of them, in different disciplines, chemistry, physics, and so on. And then they bring in about 600 young scientists. And young is defined as 35 years or less. And they put them together. They have lectures, but they have very informal meetings, and they have social gatherings and so on. And it turns out to be a very inspiring thing for the young people who really, really show that they move into science with a different energy and so on and so forth. It turns out Germans have been doing it for 68 years. They started it. Now Singapore has something that they call GIS, which is Global Young Scientist Summit or something like that. Japan has their own. It's called HOPE, and so on. The Asian countries are really catching on to this. The U.S. does not have anything even comparable to this.
But, I mean, the difference, I think, is, well, I don't show the difference, but in the U.S., though, there are numerous meetings around the nation.
Yes.
The American Chemical Society has its biannual, I mean, twice a year meeting, and all the regions have a meeting every year. So there are a plethora of arenas where, in fact, this type of exposure of the younger people, as long as you, in fact, though, make sure that you're getting these Nobel laureate people to go to the regions.
The problem with that, Keith, is that the exposure that the young people have to the Nobel laureate, say, it's typically just a lecture, and they see the lecture and that's the end of it. They don't really get the mentoring component.
So this is a 2 or 3 day operation, you're thinking?
Even
about.
Longer, 5 days.
Five days.
The way the Germans do it, and all of them do it 5 days.
Yeah.
We're trying to see if we can do a 3 day analog, although I would like to for it to be longer. Costs associated with it are an issue and so on, because it is an expensive program bringing so many people.
Yeah, right.
We want to run a pilot, so that's item number one that I want, is run a pilot.
Well, let me interject there, because as a young boy, I was 11 or 12, I went to the Royal Society in London and listened to a lecture by Lawrence Bragg. He was the person who, you know, found out the way to take a crystal and do a structure by hitting x-rays on it and looking at the refractions and stuff. And it was amazing. And I just remember one thing. I don't remember anything he said. He looked like Colonel Sanders. That was the first part. Not that I knew who Colonel Sanders was. But he had this big barrel of sand. And he just said, oh, and pressed a button, aerated it, and a duck floated to the top. And then he talked about what was happening, but it's just the image of the duck slowly rising to the surface and floating. It was lovely.
A thing like that can change everything. You're just absolutely mesmerized. You're impressed. It just turns you on.
Anyway, that's one of the things you're interested in.
But that
in.
Doesn't always happen when you just see one lecture
I
or
got
one
you.
Thing.
No, no.
So having the mentoring Nobel laureates, by the way, I want to do not just Nobel laureates. I want to do Nobel laureates, but the chemical enterprise is very diverse. And many people are interested in industry or in going to a national lab. So I would like to bring Nobel laureate caliber people, you know, CEOs from Dow.
So they would all have to spend the 3 or 4 days. They've got to buy into this commitment.
You betcha. You betcha.
That's great.
And my partner in crime is Fraser's daughter. He's helping me push the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Through the bureaucracy at the ACS. There is a bureaucracy, so it's not
any big organization.
Right.
Tell me, I mean, I alluded to it anyway, the dusty corner of the periodic table. I think it would be remiss not to mention that this year, which is not quite 2020, but it's 2019, which is not bad vision anyway, I suppose, either. Pretty good. The periodic table, as is known by anybody, I mean, most people, if you see a periodic table and you've never studied science, people say, oh, that's the periodic table. And they may know Mendeleev. Mm-hmm. And the ACS is sort of, along with all the other societies, is there anything special that you yourself have an imagination about how the periodic table was important to you? Or is it just you grew up with it and didn't think about it?
No, I think it's one of those amazing things in chemistry. I mean, the fact that people were able to predict the properties of elements that were not even discovered at the time, which was really...
Well, that was Mendeleev's great genius, right.
But in my personal career, I guess, or research, more so now than before, I am aware of, because I am working now with uranium, I guess you have heard.
Right.
And we're looking at very fundamental bonding properties of uranium with elements, things that had not been seen before. And the trick that we're playing is we're using these carbon cages to encapsulate these uranium species inside to stabilize them.
And then there's the so-called buckyballs for you out there.
Right.
I mean, they're just like little footballs, and inside you can trap all sorts of unique species.
Yes.
And it's become, so you've got the periodic table as your palette, like it is mine. I mean, I've got three elements that I've got to do before I completed a large number of the periodic table.
We just reported together with Sky Fortier, our colleague, we just reported the first true unsupported double bonds between uranium and carbon that had been looked for by inorganic chemists for decades and decades. And we isolated it inside one of these buckyballs, a carbon ball.
And the very nice thing, I must let the audience know this, it's purely serendipitous. Okay, it's not like you set out a long synthetic, like Bob Woodward, Professor Woodward, when he was trying to make vitamin, whatever it was, tedious pathway. Here you just got a plan, you just vaporize carbon in the presence of uranium, and whoop-de-doo,
yes.
How'd they fall? It's wonderful.
I'm actually very good at serendipity. I give a talk, the title of which is Serendipity Serendipitous, and it's a very interesting talk, because to a large extent, it is not. You can actually put yourself in situations that actually breed serendipity come your way. So the kind of research that we're doing, and that's one of the areas of research we do, is putting yourself in clear situation where serendipity will happen,
is gonna happen all the time.
And it happens all the time. So,
tell us, Professor Etchegoyen, Luis, right now, science is under threat as far as Keith Panel's concerned. I see it from governments, I see it from agencies, and you hear it in the popular press, that there are people who believe in science and there are people who believe in science fiction. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, more and more of what you might term the controlling bureaucracy of the society is on that second half. They don't like science, mm-hmm. because it somehow interferes with their presuppositions.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is an important area for the ACS. How do you counter this?
Yeah, well, I can do what I can do. And I will go back a little bit to my director position at the National Science Foundation. In all honesty to you, when I went there, I thought that I was going to have the ability to lobby Congress. But since National Science Foundation is part of the executive branch, it is forbidden to lobby. So I was on... And that really frustrated the heck out of me.
And you didn't know when you went.
I didn't know when I went there. So that kind of left me with this desire. And one of the reasons I went for the third time around for the ACS is, as president of ACS, I have 151,000 members behind me. That's a lot of muscle. So I can go to Congress, and now legally I can lobby Congress as much as I want.
Now, do we do that now to any large extent?
Yes. We have a very big group within the ACS, actually. It's an office that is run by Glenn Roskin. And the whole thing that they do is public affairs and public relations. And it's all about lobbying Congress. There is annually, the ACS has a group of people, and they train this group of people to show up at congressmen doors and pitch for fundamental science, invest in science.
That's in terms of budgetary commitment.
Correct. Which is one of the things that very important to do. If you like science.
Without the money, we don't do what we would like.
We don't do anything.
Right.
Right.
But I was thinking more in terms of, let me think about this. One of the things that the American government sort of runs by is this so-called lobbying. Mm-hmm. And so the ACS would just be another lobby. It would be another, you know, highly qualified, but it's just another one in line.
Right.
Whereas if you could somehow fund certain key members of Congress to go on a lecture tour, right? Like, I mean, you go on lecture tours. I go on lecture tours and give talks at universities. But simply say, look, we want to fund 2-3 Congress people who have got some clout and some interest, obviously, also, but have them come out to a range of regional universities, see what happens at UT El Paso, why science is important, why you see these new students that we're producing. Bring them out of the Washington circle as opposed to you going in to lobby. I mean, is that at all reasonable?
No, I think it is possible, but for that you need to have more representation in Congress of people who really are in love with science, right? Chemistry or whatever. Yeah. It turns out, I think this is true today. I know that it was true about a year ago when I was actually campaigning for this position. There was only one PhD scientist in all of Congress. That includes the representatives, House of Representatives, and the Senate. Yeah. One. And actually, he wrote, Bill Foster from Illinois, and he wrote an article complaining that what happened was that all his colleagues were coming to him because they don't know any science in Congress. So what is one of the things that I'm doing right now is we're going to run a presidential symposium in Philadelphia. We're going to put a group of people from government, and it's very complicated to tell you what the program will be. But the whole topic is, are you thinking about running for office? Because the first step is we need to get more scientists, like the Asian countries have. That most of the people in power are technical people and scientists.
Well, it turns out we've only got a minute or two left, Louis. So give me some words.
Yeah. You said something earlier. I'm going to try as president of ACS as much as I can to get more scientists into Congress. We need that desperately. I think that's number one. Then we can do what you were suggesting earlier. I'm going to lobby for more money, obviously, for fundamental research. In the meantime, and I disagree with something you said at the beginning, you said the world is not turning its back on science. Asian countries are doing extremely well for science. And that's where the future is. I think science will continue to flourish and do beautiful. I mean, the amount, I can tell you some statistics from ACS. Last year was the first year that the number of publications coming from Asian countries was high, from China, was larger than the number published by Americans in American Chemical Society journals. First time that has happened. And guess what? It's going to continue happening. So I think science in the hands of the Asian countries for the moment being is doing very well. The trick is going to be to convince us, the U.S., and the Western world.
We've got to finish. Louis Etchegoyen, been a pleasure chatting with you again in a studio. And I'd like to thank Sam Cassiano for putting the program together. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Adios.